Live from Dr. Henry Armitage Memorial High School AV Room, welcome to episode 115 of the Horror Pod Class. My name is Tyler, and I run Signal Horizon, a magazine dedicated to exploring genre fiction in and out of the classroom.
And I'm Oren Gray, author and general purveyor of weirdness here at Signal Horizon and elsewhere.
In an alternate universe, in an alternate world, I could see you running like a curio shop, you know, and being an actual purveyor of weirdness. So
that'd be great. I would enjoy that a lot.
Right. That's what we were all meant to do, probably. So welcome, and thanks so much for joining us tonight. Here on the Horror Podcast, we're going to spend some time talking about what we've been watching, what we've been reading. We're going to help you find some free genre content on the internet. And finally, we're going to spend the remainder of tonight's episode exploring our folk horror roots with the 1971 folk horror basic, Blood on Satan's Claw. So welcome, Oren. Tell us what have you been doing since last you joined us here on the Horror Pod Class?
Well, I can finally reveal now, because the column actually went up, that I've been watching Friday the 13th, the series, because I have a column writing about it at Signal Horizon now.
Yeah.
And I had never seen it before, so I agreed to write this column sight unseen. I had not seen a single episode when this came up. So it's been good, though. So that I've been watching that. I'm like a little over halfway through the first season, I think, at this point. So
talk to me a little bit about it. When we were talking through the idea, I don't know if I didn't know that you'd never seen it before. Genuinely, what do you think?
It's pretty good. First of all, the first thing that comes to mind, which I'm going to talk about in some future columns, is that it is so Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but Buffy really owes a huge debt to this show. Like, the tone is similar, and the basic structure, it's really similar, except there's a lot less like punching and kicking.
Yeah. Scooby gang is a little smaller, maybe. Yeah.
It's like, it's a lot darker than I was expecting it to be at first. Like, it's a lot bloodier than I was expecting. There's a David Cronenberg episode, and the David Cronenberg episode is fucking gory as hell.
I love it.
CBS in like 87 is bonkers to me.
Yeah.
But they're all pretty bloody, but a lot of them are pretty bloody, and they get pretty grim at times, which I was not. Like, the tone of the show is very like light, almost like Buffy, like, right? Like, there's these people and they're friends and they're doing this thing, but like the tone of what they're trying to stop is really grim a lot of the time, and it's a weird combo that I was not expecting, but it's really good.
Yeah. I think you're right. It's been, I don't know, way too long since I've seen an episode, but I remember them having that kind of Buffy feel about them. But I also remember them because, I think I watched them either when they came out or right after they were syndicated, when they would show on USA at like 10 o'clock at night or something. Right. But they're almost entirely all bottle episodes, right? I don't remember a through line of any kind really in there.
Like, there's tiny bits of like character progression, but they're really minor. So far anyway, there's a will they won't they between the two young leads, and there's she has a fiance at the beginning that kind of has a reckoning partway through the first season and that kind of stuff, but it's all pretty minor stuff for the most part as far as continuity goes.
Yeah. Well, I am a little bit jealous just because I think so fondly back on that moment in time, right? Like, in that moment in time, you have those, and you also have Tales from the Crypt.
Yeah.
Right? It was roughly about that time. Mm-hmm. You then have Tales from the Dark Side, which is also kind of doing...
Which actually came first.
Oh, okay.
I didn't realize that. Like, in my head, Tales from the Crypt was one of the first ones, but now Tales from the Dark Side is several years before Tales from the Crypt, actually. But yeah, like, yeah, but it was really kind of a golden age for anthology TV right then. Like,
yeah, horror anthology. TV, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we could have probably a whole separate podcast just talking our way through all, because there's so much content, you know, just in those three together. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, if we ever get sick of talking about the pseudo smart side of horror, then we'll just go talk about Tales from the Crypt episodes, dude.
Yeah.
I'd be down for that shit.
Good Lord. There's like, what, 12 seasons or something of Tales from the Crypt? There's a lot.
Yeah.
I don't have all of them. So.
Well, I wanted to, like, I desperately want to be a comic book nerd. I am not a comic book nerd by any stretch, but I'm like, I could get into collecting Tales from the Crypt, the original Tales from the Crypt comic books. Like, you've got to fucking sell a lung or something to get, like, they are outrageously expensive. So
Are you familiar with I want to say it's called like Yoe Books, Y-O-E?
Oh,
hang on a second.
Ooh, Warren's going off camera here. Who knows what he's going to spring back into with.
So, like,
okay, Yoe, got it.
Yeah. So Yoe and IDW. So Yoe puts out these collections of old, like, pre-code horror comics, right? So
they these
really nice hardcover, like, Gorgo. This is a collection of Gorgo comics they put out, but they do like tons of different pre-code horror comics, and just like package them up in these really nice hardcovers, and they're really affordable. They're like $20 or something.
Oh, dude, that's great. Yeah.
And they have tons and tons of them out. And the guy who puts them together, his name's Steve Baines. He's actually, we're Facebook friends, but he lives in St. Louis, actually, so not that far from us, really. So yeah, but anyway, they're really cool, and they do a lot of those like pre-code, really weird Tales of the Crypt type. They're not usually the Tales from the Crypt ones, because those are someone else has the copyright,
syndicated, and yeah. If somebody's got some money, I love it. I'll have to hit that up. That's pretty rad, dude. Well, I feel like I've done nothing but watch stuff since we met last. And I still have like a mountain of other stuff I need to cover. Let's start first and foremost. The kind folks at RLJE sent me this bad boy. This is Arch Enemy, which is kind of the newest The newest take on a dark superhero, right?
Okay.
It's more action than I would say horror. But it would be a little bit like if Unbreakable was directed by an action director instead of like a horror director, I guess. You know, like, it was fun and it was enjoyable. Totally pick up the DVD if that sounds like something that you're interested in. There's a making of featurette on the DVD that's pretty interesting, if you're into like filmmaking and that stuff. It was fine. Probably the other thing that I got the other day, if you can see that because of the light, maybe if I can get closer, Random Acts of Violence, which is a movie that, believe it or not, I'm pretty sure I caught at Panic Fest a while ago. I think it was Panic Fest. You know what? 2018 and 2019 all blend together. That's all we have, right?
And they were a million years ago.
Yeah. Now,
because 2020 was so long and weird.
But yeah. Right. But the premise is there is it's a slasher for sure, but it's essentially about a comic book artist, and you don't really know his role either as the slasher or as the guy that writes about the slasher. You know, it's that kind of methodology. It's that kind of plot.
Right.
But totally worth seeing because it's got this really, really harsh comic book veneer to it. So it really is stylized. Very cool. It's out very, very soon from Shudder. They have a great release for it coming up. Oh, it's actually out now, I think, on DVD, so you can totally check it out there. And the last thing that I was watching is Silence and the Darkness, which is now currently out on VOD. And this one reminds me of, did you ever see Night Mama?
Night Mama?
It's the weird foreign film with the twins.
Good night, mommy.
There you go.
I didn't ever see it. No, actually, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it uses the trope of a set of siblings. One, I believe, can't hear, and the other can't speak, and is also deaf, and tells a pretty traditional horror story that way. It was super enjoyable. Little kids creep the hell out of me. And unlike the other movie that I was talking about, there's not a hard twist to it. And I also didn't see that hard twist coming like a billion miles away, which I did on Mommy Dearest or whatever that one was. I think maybe the same director did The Lodge.
I just checked that. Yeah.
Yay.
I was like, there's some reason why I never went back and watched that. And it's because it was the person who made The Lodge. Okay.
Yeah. Right. And I get that plenty of people like The Lodge, and probably plenty of people like Dearest Mama or Mama Dearest or whatever.
I'm never going to correct you. I'm going to let you keep calling it weird.
Yeah, things. Whatever. Mommy, I want a cookie. I don't know. You can call it whatever. I did not care for either movie because like the kids are awful and they're more annoying than they even are evil. So that's cool. This movie though, I fully recommend. It is out now. You should totally check it out.
Okay, so this is Silence in the Darkness that we
Silence in out? The Darkness. Yep.
Okay. And that's all one movie. That sounds like it could be two movies, but that's all one movie. Okay.
Yeah, you need to see Silence first, which is really just an hour's worth of silence. And then the last 30 minutes, which we call darkness, you don't have...
you don't see anything. It's just a bunch of noises, right?
Right, right. You put them together movie. And you have a full film, right?
I kind of want to make that movie now.
That's a free idea. I've given it to you completely, so... the last thing I should mention is I have been picking my way through Undertow's new collection, Shadows in Tall Trees 8, I believe. And it's full of fantastic stuff by Kurt Favre, which we're going to mention in just a moment. And I don't know, like you name it, like the people that are writing short horror fiction, present company excluded, of course, are in that particular anthology and are just doing a bang up job with it. So you can get that. It's out.
Great stuff.
Currently from Undertow. So I think that covers it more or less. I've been kind of dabbling in some other stuff, but I probably will save that for the next episode because there's so much to talk about tonight.
Yeah.
And something that we haven't done in so long. Let's play some horror trivia.
Oh God. Okay.
Yeah.
This will go great.
Okay. So everyone watching at home, share this video with your friends. Let's get everybody involved. If you know the answer before Oren does, I might send you some really cool Signal Horizon swag. I just got a whole bunch more of that stuff in the mail. So, nope, this is a Midnight Meat Train question. I remember that from last time we played, so maybe it would help if I
sort these better. Yeah,
I know. Okay. All right. Here we go. One more. We're gonna try it. Let's go. Question one. This is the purple bat category, Oren. Remember, we don't really know what these are.
We did it one time. We just need to go back and watch the episode where we figured out what they are, and then we'll know again.
Yeah, right. Somebody can help us maybe in the chat here. And again, when you comment, it pops up on our screen, so feel free to shout out. All right. Purple Bat for 100, please, Alex. What is the relationship between Ginger and Bridget in Ginger Snaps 2000 version?
Is there another version? They're sisters. Is there another version?
I don't know. Did they remake it? I don't think so.
Made a bunch of sequels and a prequel, but I don't know. Weird.
Anyway. Yeah. And I adore them all. Even the prequel that is silly as hell is a whole lot of fun to watch. So
I haven't seen them in forever, like the sequels and stuff, but I need to rewatch too because I remember being really weird.
Yeah. Hey, let's see. Somebody else got the right answer, but got it after we did. Leland says, sisters, you are correct. All right. Question two. This is the slightly turquoise, slightly blue eyeball. Ready? Here we go.
Sure.
The murder of what family member does Sheriff Wydell avenge in The Devil's Rejects? I would not. I'm terrible at this shit.
Like, I've seen it. I know it's a relative.
I listened to the question. I could repeat parts of the question.
Niece? Is it niece?
Great try. The correct answer is his brother.
Oh, that's right, because she's... No. Hell, I don't remember.
Yeah, it's been too long. Forever. I do need to go back and revisit that stuff.
So his brother is the sheriff from the other one?
I think so. I think that's
okay.
Right.
Okay, yeah. That sounds right.
We're constructing more of this movie where...
I'm going to build... build the answer to this question eventually from information presented in the question.
Hey, you're using your context clues. It's what we talk about in class all the time. All right, here we go. Question three. This is the purple brain category. In what persona does the titular character of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde remain upon his death? 1931 version. Right up your alley, dude.
Oh, man, 31 version.
Come on, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde.
I want to say Mr. Hyde. I haven't seen it in a long time.
He dies as Dr. Jekyll. He stays as Dr. Jekyll. Okay. Yeah. Moving quickly to the orange pentagram category. In what Italian city is John Baxter restoring an old church in Don't Look Now from 1973?
Venice.
Man, he says very confidently.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it. I've never seen it.
Oh, my God. It's so good. We should do it for an episode. It's so good.
Okay. We'll add it to the list. All right. Here we go. This is the yellow hockey mask. I'm almost 100% certain the yellow hockey mask, because it's very evident, is Slashers, I think. So what Christian ceremony is Karen attending on the day she is murdered in Alice, Sweet Alice?
Baptism. Took me a minute to think of the word.
That is incorrect.
What?
It's her first communion. That's
communion. First communion. Damn it.
It's not hers.
It's her sister's.
It all blends together.
No, she's the one who's murdered. Okay. Never mind. Yes. First communion. Sorry.
Yeah. This is why we do these things. We get our brains up and working.
I just couldn't think. Yeah. The word was wrong. No, you're right.
At least you have some clue on some of these, because
it's also super good. Incidentally.
Yeah. So damn. I think you reviewed the DVD for us back in the day. Because it made me, I didn't go get that DVD, but I did find a copy. And you know me, I'm woefully short when it comes to like my older horror stuff, but you are slowly fixing that problem. So
yes.
All right. Last question. This is The Green World. The killer in The Bird with the Crystal Plumage from 1970 wears what color gloves?
I'm going to assume black.
Great guess. That is correct. So,
I mean, it's a giallo. They all fucking wear black gloves. I've also seen it. It's really good. But yeah, like, just safe to assume, right?
All right. So looks like you did okay. 50%. 50% is not bad. Hey, and Leland's been guessing along right with us. He guessed purple the last one. We know it's black because it's a giallo film. So,
and they all fucking wear black. There's got to be at least one where they don't. But man, yeah, it's a safe guess.
Okay, we'll keep that in the back of our minds. So, just a moment ago, I mentioned the new anthology by Undertow, Shadow and Tall Trees, and there is a fantastic short story by Kurt Favre. Speaking of, we need to get him on the show someday, because I think he would be a hoot to have on here.
Yeah.
Called Workday, which is all told in a series of like memos, kind of like office memos. So it's definitely corporate horror for those folks that are really into that. And it is fantastic in how it builds dread, and it's got this kind of Lovecraftian corporate entity that hangs over it. So if you don't feel like going and buying Shadow and Tall Trees, which you should from Undertow, you can check it out, that story out for free from Pseudopod. So it was, cool. I think, one of their Christmas episodes they just had on. So just a couple of months ago. And it is so good and so fun. And there's this like you get occasionally this other voice coming in because it's all about whether or not you should go to this Christmas party, right?
Right.
And corporate is like, everyone must go to this Christmas party. And then occasionally you'll get this voice to break through that'll be like, don't go to the Christmas party. Historically, this corporation has killed people and blah, 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 right? And there's this neat little moment in the parking garage where like the voice gets through again and like spray paints like the corporation is evil or whatever it is they spray paint. I forget. But then the corporation puts out a memo that's like, we're so sorry for the mess in the parking garage. And, you know, it's just so the tone of a big corporation is like so perfect fully through that short story that it was like, I hate Christmas parties. And one of the great things about COVID is that we haven't had to go to any of them, you know, and I hope that stays. So the short story is excellent. And it
parties
is
can just all be canceled.
Yeah. Right. Right. Like as long as the movie theaters can open, then parties can stay canceled. How about that?
That works for me.
All right. I think it may be time to move on to, our essential question of the night. What do you think, man?
I think so.
All right. So our essential question is, using the blood on Satan's claw, how has folk horror evolved? And I'm going to pull up, if I can find it. Here we go. I'm going to pull up the trailer. Let's all watch the trailer.
Of the devil is disturbed by the plow. The satanic essence of evil wreaks violent and revolting revenge.
But it weren't human, sir. They were fur.
Then it was an animal's remains.
It were more like some fiend.
And the evil grows quickly, attacking first the youth of the village and making them the devil's children.
Ralph, look. Look.
Oh, God, I prayed I'd never see that again. That's what they call the devil's skin.
Doctor, witchcraft is dead and discredited. Are you bent on reviving forgotten horrors?
How do we know, sir, what is dead?
Blood on Satan's claw was like a horrible disease. Highly contagious and deadly dangerous.
Hail, Behemoth, spirit of the dark, take thou my blood, my flesh, my skin, and walk. Holy Behemoth, father of my life, speak now, come now, rise now from the forest, from the far...
Blood on Satan's Claw stars Patrick Wymark as the judge who tries the devil, Linda Hayden as Angel Blake, daughter of Satan, Barry Andrews as a victim but innocent, Michelle Dautrice as the devil's child, and James Hayter as the village squire.
Thou stole my master's skin. Thou shalt pay with thine.
I think thou could be saved.
These dogs know how to tear the devil's heel.
Thou telltale bitch, thou set the dogs on me.
Of course I didn't.
Art thou ready to give thy skin tonight?
Art thou ready?
Blood on Satan's claw.
All right. Did we give a shout out to whoever the DVD maker was there? But so give us, not to put you on the spot here, but I think we have a pretty good idea of the plot. Long story short, there's some bad children that continue to do Satan's work. And probably the important part of all of this is the introduction of the devil's skin, right?
Which is one of the alternate titles that the movie was released under. It was like Satan's Skin, which is also a very lurid title.
Yeah. Well, we'll get into the nitty gritty of exactly what folk horror is about and whatnot in just a moment. But like that luridity, if that is a word, right? It feels a little dirty, right? And there is a lot of nudity and it is salacious, right? Feels like an important element of folk horror generally, especially of this time, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was definitely kind of a hallmark of horror of this time, especially like, but the folk horror ones, the ones that we talk about when we talk about the folk horror, the Unholy Trinity that we're going to get into here in a minute, they all have in common like a very mean-spirited quality. Like they are cruel in ways that the other horror movies at the time were not.
Yeah,
to the same extent.
Yeah, and I think there are so many interesting things about this period. And maybe before we get into the intricacies of each movie, you had mentioned the Holy Trinity. Now, the Unholy Trinity, if you will. Yeah. What three movies are included in that?
So the typical inclusions are this one, Witchfinder General, and Wicker Man.
Yeah, all right.
And Witchfinder General was actually the first one made. It was 69, 67, I don't remember. And then this one, and then Wicker Man.
So. Okay. And we've talked about Wicker Man on a previous episode way, way, way back, I think it's season one. And I think it shares a lot of similarities with this film. It is, I think The Blood on Satan's Claw is maybe a little darker. Wicker Man feels light from time to time, like almost like a musical, right? Because it kind of is. This does not have that appeal to it.
Now it is, and I would argue that Witchfinder General might be even more grim than this one. Like it is rough,
that movie. Yikes.
Which is weird because it's like a Vincent Price movie made by AIP. So like you're expecting it to be along the lines of like the Roger Corman Poe movies, right? It was even released as The Conqueror Worm in the United States to cash in on those Poe movies. And it's not. It is super rapey and grim and rough. Like it is fucking rough.
The thing that I was so struck by, right, and maybe it exists in Wicker Man and I've just forgotten, which is could absolutely be the thing, but you know, I was rewatching this last night for the show to make sure it was, you know, fresh in my mind, and my wife had sat down to like read a book or, you know, grade some homework, whatever it is us teachers are doing at night. And she just happened to sit down right before the incredibly grim, incredibly terrifying rape scene in this movie. And like, there's no getting around. It's brutal and very there and very very graphic, I would say, especially for the time. And I was like, wow, this sucks. Cause up until that moment, there is a little bit of sketchiness, but nothing like that. You know, I was like, oh shit, we're going all in this particular setting.
And like one of the things that's, I think key to this, and it's kind of true in Wicker Man, but Wicker Man's its own beast. Like it's its own kind of creature, but there are no good guys in this really. Right. The person they identify in the trailer as like a victim but innocent or whatever is the closest thing we get.
Yeah.
Like the judge who is our Van Helsing figure is a horrible fucking person.
Right. Right. Right.
Like he is trash. Like he is a terrible person. He's also like on the right side in this movie. Like we're supposed to like, you know, the conclusion that we reach is that he is indeed doing righteous work. But he's doing it in a horrible way.
Yeah.
And he is a horrible person. And like, I don't think the movie, that's not an accident. Like the movie, it's not the 60s having, or the 70s having different morals than us. Or no, this is, he's supposed to be a terrible person. Like there's not supposed to be any good in this really.
Yeah. Well, he's got a bit of a soliloquy or whatever you want to call it at the beginning where people are like, you've got to help us. And he's like, okay, I'm going to help you, but I'm going to use whatever method I want to use. And like,
it's such a good, I wrote it down. It's such a good line. I shall use undreamed of measures.
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah, that's,
but at least in, maybe you can help me out here. Maybe I missed something, but like undreamed of measures seems to be setting expectations very high with like, at least creativity or something, right? And as far as I can find, it's all pretty basic stuff, you know? Pretty evil, awful, terrible, but pretty, you know, like sicking dogs on people has been around forever. Like, you haven't invented that one there, you know, guy. Yeah. So
I mean, I think what it boils down to is like, essentially, it's just like, all these kids, you know, your children, right? This village, all your children, they're all evil now. We're going to kill them. It's basically what he's told. We're going to kill all your children. Heads up. There's no saving them. We're just going to murder them. So as you know.
Right. And I think about half the parents would be like, yeah, you know, I'm maybe not, you know, and the other half are like, fuck it. Yep. You know, like, that's fine. They play in the woods all day long. They're worthless. They don't clean their rooms. It's like, oh, all right. Yeah. So I think now is an important time to probably discuss. There is a ton of literature out there on folk horror generally. And I want to make a shout out to something Leland has mentioned here in the chat. Adam Scoville's got a book all about folk horror. I have not read it, but sounds interesting. But Don Keatley, who is a modern horror scholar, she's one of the editors and folks that run Horror Homeroom, which is another fantastic, if you like kind of smart horror takes, it's another fantastic website to head to. But she's got a great horror or a great paper all about defining what folk horror really is. Okay. And she's got it broken down into three categories. I absolutely adore those categories. And I think they were really illustrative to help me kind of understand it. Number one, every folk horror film has to have some sort of mysterious countryside, right? You can't really do folk horror in the city, right? It changes. It would be something different. So it's got to be in the countryside. Second, it has to involve some sort of monstrous tribe. That would be a group of people that an outsider would feel is different and monstrous and does messed up stuff, right? So I would say Blood on Satan's Claw is 2 for 2, right? So far, right? Yeah. And that was one of the takeaways from this film for me was like the stuff looks legitimately like it's shot in the woods, right? Like people run into tree branches and when they fall down hills, it looks like it probably hurt. And, you know, like it's believable. It doesn't look like it's in somebody's backyard. It looks like they dragged a bunch of people out.
Not to derail your 3 points.
No, you're good.
But it's like a key thing. For me, like this and Witchfinder General have in common is that they look really grimy. Like everything looks filthy and grimy and poor and rough. And like it's really well exemplified in that opening shot that was in the trailer too of the like wagon wheel turning through the dirt and it zooms in on the wheel and the wheel's all encrusted with mud. Right? Like that's. That is the aesthetic of these movies, 100%.
Yeah, crusted with mud.
Yeah.
I need more of those movies like, in my life.
It's crusted with mud, and it's hard to do. Like, it's not. There's nothing bucolic about this pastoral. Like,
yeah,
it's
right.
Miserable here. Yeah. Right, like even the good people. In fact, especially the good people are miserable here.
Yeah, and I think kind of taps into. Oh, some modern folk horror stuff. And we'll talk about kind of the evolution of what folk horror looks like in just a minute. But like The Witch, right?
Oh, yeah.
Also taps into the fact that like not only did puritanical times suck because like the people sucked and they could burn you because you'd be a witch and you know, whatever, but like literally the setting and surroundings were awful. Nobody is having fun in this setting. It's totally and completely miserable. So yeah,
and it makes Satan's temptation seem so understandable, right? Like, yeah, anything would be better than this.
Yeah. And wait a minute. Now I can go have fun with my friends and like have a bunch of sex and theoretically, you know, get access to all of this fun that I am clearly not having.
You're not having, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, honestly, the comparison sounds a whole lot like being in quarantine, you know, like there is going to be a whole subset of like post quarantine folk horror that it's like,
would still like to go to a movie.
Yeah. Yeah. All you have to do is sign your name in the black book and you can have a drink at the bar. Like, fuck it. Sign me up. Sign me up. Yeah. Okay. So go ahead.
Sorry, no. So a thing. So I did a long time ago, I did a bunch of research into like old, you know, like, pseudoscience and like folk magic and like people like Paracelsus and those kind of people, Pliny the Elder, and those kind of people who wrote about what beliefs existed at the time and wrote about them as though they were factual. And I did tons of digging into this, and I found like a big list of demons you could summon up at one point. I don't remember where. And like these demons, like they ran the gamut of what they would do. But like, so there's one where you summon them up and they poison your enemies or whatever, right? There's one where you summon them up and they like give you riches, right? And there's one where you summon it up and it will sing, it will perform any song you want to hear. And that's it.
So it's like the Spotify demon.
Right. And like, but you know, when you think back, like you couldn't hear that song any other way, right? Like we didn't have CDs or anything yet, right? You had to find someone who knew the song and was good,
right? Yes.
So, it's like, so yeah, like we're gonna have like post COVID, we're gonna have like pandemic demons. It's just like, no, yeah, you can have a drink.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you can get within 6 feet of someone and not right. catch a disease. Yeah, like hail payment. Right. Yeah 100%. Looking for that demon if we can find him. That demon is called a vaccine, and I, as a teacher, still have not even received a date or a time to get mine. Like, there's like, whatever, here in the county that I am, they're like still vaccinating 90-year-olds that have like comorbidities, you know. I'm like, Jesus, it's gonna be in June. Anyways, I digress. Back to folk horror. So the third thing, according to Don Keatley, according to Professor Keatley, is that a society must believe in a witch. They don't have to, like, that witch doesn't have to be real, but there is a real importance placed on this thing, this mythological creature, right? In the movie that we're talking about tonight, it is, you know, Satan, right? In Wicker Man, it is a bigger pagan god, of which, you know, it's like a fertility or, you know, a crop god, right? Whatever it may be. But I found her analysis that it doesn't necessarily have to be real to be really important for the evolution of folk horror, because it really is the first time that we have seen like the idea that belief in a thing gives it power. Right. And that becomes a reoccurring trope throughout a lot of different horror movies.
Yeah. And I mean, it's really vital, honestly, to the sort of unholy trinity of folk horror, because this one is the only one that has overt supernatural stuff in it. Right. Like in Wicker Man, it's ambiguous. And in Witchfinder General, there's just none. 100% witches do not exist in Witchfinder General.
Huh. Okay.
The Witchfinder in question is the villain. There are no witches.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in the bottom line is, outside of, and maybe I missed something, which could absolutely be the case, but outside of Satan's skin, right? Mm-hmm. There's nothing supernatural. I mean, very clearly, yes, a patch of fur that shows up on somebody is not normal. But I mean,
there's like a big monster hanging out over there.
That is
true. He's the actual devil, probably.
Yeah, yeah. You do get yeah. You're right. Well, I'm trying to. Like I'm trying to get to a place where that power and belief in that monster or whatever gives that monster power and like corporeal form and all that kind of jazz. Because it did, when I was first reading this article, it reminded me of the first Nightmare on Elm Street movie, right? Mm-hmm. Where, like, Nancy beats Freddy Krueger, not by, like, burning his bones or by, you know, turning into a dream warrior or whatever the fuck, right? She, mm-hmm. like, simply denies his existence, you know? And so my question to you then is, as we transition into that kind of evolution of what folk horror looks like, is Nightmare on Elm Street a folk horror movie?
I don't know. I would dispute her. I don't know if dispute is the right word. I would
push back.
I would modify her three criteria, because I 100% think Candyman is a folk horror movie.
Yeah, that's something Leland said in chat here. So talk to us about that.
Well, okay. So, and it's basically, right, it's basically matches the three, except the countryside is instead a neighborhood. Like, it's a region, but it's a region where you can be an outsider, right? Mm-hmm. Like, in this case, it's the Cabrini Green, right? Cabrini Green is very much this insulated, separate community where the protagonist is an outsider. And they believe, the people in Cabrini Green, in Candyman, right? They believe in him 100%, whether he's real or not. And the movie sort of implies that maybe he's not, until someone who doesn't believe in him shows up, and then he is, in order to prove that he is, he becomes real. That her doubt is actually what brings him to life.
Ooh, I like it. Okay.
Instead of their belief, to some extent. Like, it is her disbelief that he comes to punish, essentially. Okay.
All right, so we are going to use your metaphor. All right, Candyman is the modern evolution of folk horror.
A modern evolution, anyway.
Okay, yeah. Sure. So, what happened in the popular culture zeitgeist that we transitioned from belief in something gives the monster power to doubt in something gives the monster power? Because I think those are way different and really interesting.
Well, and I'm not sure that we did. Like, okay. Because in Blood on Satan's Claw, the people believe in what's happening, or the kids do, but the judge doesn't. Right? When the guy comes to the judge and he's like, oh my God, I plowed up the devil in my field. The judge is like, that's fucking stupid.
Yeah.
You plowed up like an animal or something. Don't waste my time. And it's only, like, when shit starts going wrong. Like, he leaves. And then he's like, and I'm going to fuck off the town. See you guys later.
I got shit to do. Yeah.
Right. I'm busy and important and F you peasants. But, like, you know, it's only, like, his doubt sows the opportunity, right, for it to grow. If he had been like, fuck, yeah, you're right. Let's go check that shit out right now. Right. It might not have had the opportunity to take root, and it took root right first in the house he was in. The first place it manifests is in the house he lives in or staying in.
Okay.
And so I'm not sure there was ever. I think there was always a charge between doubt and belief in folk horror for as long as we've had it in movies anyway, because it's there in Wicker Man too, right? The cop is a believer, but in something else.
Right.
He's a believer in Christianity who is thrust into this very different world that he doesn't believe in. And his disbelief dooms him.
I like it.
To a large extent. I mean, so I think there's always been a tension between belief and disbelief that has informed folk horror, at least in film.
You know? Yeah. I think you might have stumbled upon one of the key kind of factors in the way I see folk horror, which is the subtext, right? The conflict in the subtext is about that tension. It's never like, it's not about the bees, right? It's not about fucking Satan's skin. It is really the tension that comes between what we believe in, what we choose to believe in, and when we have a set of beliefs and somebody challenges them, both the children of Satan in this particular movie, but also, you know, the protagonist who doesn't necessarily believe, right? I think that is super interesting.
Right. And when he chooses to act on his beliefs or act on his lack of, when he chooses to intervene, he does so in this very like self-righteous way, right? Like, even though he denied this earlier, when he shows up, he's like, I'm on the side of God, basically. And he really shouldn't be, right? Like, he was kind of you kind of dismissed this earlier. You dropped the ball, guy.
Yeah. And now all you. These children got, right. You know, a VD that turns their skin into fur, right? Right. Way to go, dude. Yeah.
This is kind of on you, guy. Right.
Yeah. What a dirtbag. Yeah. Well, before we run out of too much time though, I wanted to talk that evolution step, right? Because there is another fascinating article, about modern folk horror as told through digital artifacts. Okay. And so the name of this article is Digital Folklore, Marble Hornets, The Slender Man, and the Emergence of Folk Horror in Online Communities. And it's by Dana Keller. And the thesis of the article I am so freaking down for, which is essentially that online communities can turn very insular and can both from a perspective of escapist entertainment, but sometimes it can take a very real turn into the real world, can immerse themselves in these folk tales, right? These modern folk tales that are just as terrifying and are just as screwed up as, I don't know, believing you got to burn a guy in a wicker man or, you know, whatever. Yeah. Right. Yeah. But
that's what QAnon is, right?
That was my immediate thought. He doesn't mention QAnon at all, but I'm like, holy shit. Like,
right? I mean, it's a monstrous tribe that believes a monstrous thing, essentially, right?
Yeah, like, right. They believe in the monster regardless of whether or not the monster is real, right? Like, it doesn't matter if Q is real or not. Like,
and like the people. And again, I keep talking about Witchfinder generally, we're supposed to be talking about Blood on Satan's Claw, but it's interesting because it's flipped, is why I keep bringing it up. But like, one of the themes that comes up a lot is that like, people who believe will do terrible things because they believe they're justified, whatever they believe, regardless of what they believe, you know. And it's in this one, it's both sides, right? The devil's children do terrible things because they worship the devil. The good guy does terrible things because he believes he has to put the devil's children down, right? Like, he does terrible things. He murders children.
Yeah. And I was working on a graphic. I didn't get it done right now, but there is a scene of like, everybody kind of celebrating around the Wicker Man. We don't get any of those wide shots in Blood on Satan's Claw, but there is this wide shot of all these people. They're not doing anything violent, but they're very clearly all there, and there's strength in numbers, right? And I juxtaposed that with the mob that attacked the Capitol, and right. I was just struck by the utter fear that someone who just like was a schlo, you know, like just a cop on at the Capitol, right? Who was like, what in God's name is this? And what have we, you know, what have we done? What has Q wrought, you know? Right. And it is these crazies that are attacking the Capitol. And I think it is easy for us in the middle of the country, who may or may not have had to deal with a family member that has succumbed to the Q cult, to make light of it. But I think in seeing it in that group context, fucking utterly and completely terrifying, right? I mean, that's scary. So the article mentions Marble Hornets, which is a fantastic ride. It's a YouTube thing. That's where we get the first introduction of Slender Man. But the very real like evolution of the Slender Man was that there was somebody that murdered, I think, three people because she was convinced that the Slender Man was real and was coming to get her, or, you know, whatever it was. But like, these things are important because A, they impact the real world, but B, they exist regardless of whether or not the Headless Horseman exists, regardless of whether or not these bads are real. And that should give all of us pause.
Yeah.
Or not, you know, whatever. The bottom line is, I think there are a whole bunch of different examples of modern folklore. The last article I want to mention is this really fantastic article about folklore in the Ozarks. And like I mentioned earlier, we are from Missouri. This one struck home and is specifically about a fantastic movie called Winter's Bone, which is what gave Jennifer Lawrence her kind of big boost. I think she was nominated and won an Academy Award for that. So
sounds right, yeah.
But it mentions how there are areas of the country, like the Ozarks, that have a set of rules and regulations that appear very foreign to somebody outside of that. And it's those kind of unspoken rules that tend to make interlopers feel uncomfortable. And at least with Winter's Bone, you overlay that with a culture of meth use. And now you have like fucking crazy people that are hopped up on drugs that are so incredibly foreign that I don't know. I found the entire article really compelling in its description of insular communities and drug use, especially as their own insular communities, as modern incantations of folklore. So,
Leaving like, because Winter's Bone is a naturalistic film, you know, for the most part, but like, more folklore really definitely needs to delve into like Ozark stuff, because there's a lot of cool like folk magic beliefs and things like that from that part of the country that we don't really have any good movies about. And we could use some.
Yeah, totally. I think this discussion, before we move on to four movies, Leland will have our last word. Folk horror tends to be a reflection of the land and thus the people. It's the horror of our own people. Yeah, dude. It's really, I've seen the monster and the monster is us, right?
Yeah. And I mean, like, as much as, so folk horror, sorry, I'm going to ramble a bit here.
Do it.
So folk horror, like we trace it back to these three movies, right? And for various reasons, these three are the ones that we kind of cite as the origin of what we currently think of as folk horror. Like, they had predecessors, of course, and of course folk horror draws from actual folk traditions and blah blah. But like, we didn't really start talking about it until like the 2010s, right? Like, it's talking about it and codifying it and grouping it like this is a relatively recent thing. And I think that there's a lot of reasons why folk horror is really resonant right now.
Oh yeah. That's great.
You know, like we're really into folk horror right now. And there's lots of reasons why. But
yeah. Yeah. Well, in I think that article by Professor Keatley I mentioned earlier discusses how the director of this film, whose name is Piers Haggard, is really given credit for kind of using the term most fluidly, or most definitionally in regards to his film in a interview that he did with Fangoria right about that time that you mentioned. I think it was like 2005, right? And then from there we kind of built up, I would say, the scholarly work around folk horror as we know it. And
like the Mark Gatiss interview thing on the BBC where he talked about folk horror, like, and kind of named these movies as what he was talking about, was like 2010. So yeah, okay. It was like the Piers Haggard interview and then him saying that, and then like most of the scholarship has come after that.
Yeah.
But also, like, there's been a really huge interest in it, right? There's been a big desire for it. There's been several books published about it, several anthologies themed around it. Like, it's really popular right now.
Yeah.
There's a lot of really good reasons.
I think that discomfort, that unease that we have regarding folk horror generally is reflective of our general unease and distrust of one another. And I think until that goes away, that there is going to be a lot of room for folk horror as we know it to develop, right?
Yeah, so like when these movies came out, right? These movies came out in the late 60s into the early 70s. We were looking at like the civil rights movement. We were looking at, you know, the hippie movement, the
culture war, right?
Culture wars, generational divides, you know, and we're kind of right there again, right?
Yeah.
Like,
right. Yeah. I like, we'll do the remake and we'll call it Blood on Q's, I don't know, Blood on Q's flag or something. I got that. That's all I got. Q's ugly Trump t-shirt. That's too wordy. We'll have to work on the title.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah. Sounds good. All right. So, now let's move on to four movies. So if you liked Blood on Satan's Claw, or are you're interested in more stuff like this, the two movies I recommend would be The Wicker Man, of course, which is, you know, part of that trio that we mentioned before, but also at least in aesthetic, not necessarily in theming or like I would still probably call it folk horror, but definitely in the aesthetic and how it's shot is Antrim, which we talked earlier this season or last season about. But it's like, you know, one of those movies that supposedly, you know, drives you insane if you watch it. It's a modern film shot to look like it's from the 70s. Yeah. So, yeah. Interesting. What were your two?
My two were Witchfinder General, just to finish out that trinity, and The Witches from 1966, which is
I don't know it. Okay, cool.
Written by Nigel Neal, which we all know how much I love Nigel Neal on this show.
Of course.
But it's very much about, like, it's a more modern, so it's modern at the time instead of being set in the past, but it's very much about, like, folk beliefs persisting in the modern day in secret, essentially.
Cool.
So,
yeah. I dig it. I know you can find Antrim and Wicker Man both, I believe, on Amazon Prime still. Any ideas where they can find yours? I put you on the spot. I didn't tell you to put this in.
I don't know off the top of my head, but I can drop them in the show notes if I find them.
Perfect.
Blood on Satan's Claw you can watch on Shudder, I believe, right?
Yeah. And also, not that I told you to do this, but I think there is a quasi-legal version on YouTube. Seems to be from like a reputable site. So I don't know if it's one of those things where the copyright is a little iffy. I don't know.
I watched it on my very nice Severin Blu-ray.
Oh, fuck yeah. Of course you have that. Yeah, of course. Well, somebody that probably watched a shady ass version of this on YouTube or somewhere else is anonymous letterbox user who left us a half star review where they argue, "I was assured that The Blood on Satan's Claw was an actually good film for years. Upon watching it, I discovered that it is a terribly boring movie, but it shows a lot of boobs, which helped tremendously. If you would like to see some terrific female nudity, you could watch The Blood on Satan's Claw, or you could just Google the word breasts and see something equally as impressive, but not nearly as long." So yeah, it does have the requisite nudity.
I mean, like, I feel like maybe I've gotten jaded by watching a lot of Jolly or something. I don't know. Like, it has, you know, it has quite a bit for 1971. But I mean, like, if what you want to see is lots of boobs, watch Strip Nude for Your Killer, the movie where no one owns clothes. Watch that movie.
Oh, okay. That's a new one for me that I will have to add to my letterbox list. Yeah, like, that was my immediate thought. There are in this film.
Yeah, you know, she's a very attractive woman, but
yeah, both of those are very true. But also, because I've seen a billion trillion horror movies, but also a billion trillion movies from like the mid to late 70s, like, before the internet, there was like HBO after 10 o'clock was showing some lame, like, Italian 1978 romance movie, you know, right? Like, come on.
I mean, right. Every movie from overseas in the 70s was just boobs from Hell to Breakfast, right?
Right. Like, right. Yeah.
That's what you got. It was all of them. Like, it's not.
Yeah. This is nothing spectacular when it comes to that.
Notable in that regard, yeah. To any huge extent.
Yeah. So as usual, our anonymous letterbox user got this one wrong.
an interesting side note, the scene when she disrobes in front of the priest in the church, in the version I first watched, which was the, I don't remember, I think it was the American version at the time, this was before the Blu-ray, the film had been artificially darkened in that shot, so it was harder to see, which was a thing that they did to like get around, not censors, but functionally censors, right, to get a better rating. They darkened the film on that shot so you couldn't see it as well.
So they did the version of like the horror video game where they're like, can you see the border? You know, and they're like, if you turn it way down, they're like, okay, I can't see anything. All right. Well, good try. Good try, censors. Good try. All right. Anything else to say about the blood on Satan's claw before we, you know, wrap up for this evening?
Sure, there should be quite a lot, but we're out of time. So
yeah, we will put all of our, like, this was one of the most fun episodes to prep for because there is so much really great, really smart literature out there about folk horror. I'm 100% confident this is not the last time we will revisit it as a topic, but probably the last time that we will visit Blood on Satan's Claw, at least in this detail, right? So very good. Oren, where can they find more of your stuff on the web, my friend?
I am, as always, Oren Gray at every place, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Letterboxd, whatever, and at orengray.com, and now a column at Signal Horizon, right?
Yeah.
About February 13th, so.
Yeah, can't wait to read the next one. You can find more of my stuff at Ty Unsel on Twitter. I'm also the one doing most of the day-to-day stuff, social media and editing and all the editor-in-chief stuff at signalhorizon.com. Speaking of, if this is your cup of tea, if this is something that is interesting to you, we would love to get your feedback. If you would go to iTunes and you know, whatever podcatching service that you use, leave us a 5-star review, subscribe, let us know that you like what we're doing in the comments. Or if you want to take it to the next level and you're like, hey, I want to contribute, I want to add something to what you guys are talking about, hit me up, Tyler@signalhorizon.com. I am always interested to get listener or viewer email. And who knows, maybe you might find yourself on staff here at Signal Horizon writing for us about, you know, some other smart or not so smart takes on horror. So speaking of slightly sketchy stuff, what are you going to recommend we talk about next time?
I'm going to keep us on the folk horror bandwagon, and we're going to talk about Rawhead Rex. Rawhead Rex.
There we go. Rawhead Rex. All right. I was going to say.
I learned that it is on Shudder.
It is on Shudder.
Yes. So I hear.
All right. I know nothing about that film other than I think you mentioned it on Twitter or some shit the other day. And I was like, I don't know what that is.
It's a Clive Barker movie. It's the terrible Clive Barker movie. So it's going to be good. It's going to be good fun.
I can't wait. One of these really terrible movies that we do, though, we got to do another live tweet and see if we can't get a big enough audience to follow the madness and the craziness that is that bonkers movie. And this one, pretty bonkers, pretty crazy.
This is gonna be good. No, it's gonna be great.
All right, dude, you are setting expectations very high, my friend. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us tonight. We'll catch you not next Thursday, but the Thursday after that, when we're talking about Rawhead Rex. Until then, witches aren't real, but you can believe in them if you want to. And class dismissed. Bye, everybody.